The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, the topic of desire has been on my mind for the last 42 years. Or so. I think one way of understanding what it means to be a student of Buddhism, a practitioner of Buddhism, is to be a student of desire. And to really understand the nature of your desire, how desires work in you, what you desire, and how you desire, and the consequences of how you desire. There's all the stuff, the whole world of desire. And it's a huge topic. I think of it as an ecosystem in its own right. And so you certainly don't want to have one simple idea about desire and feel like you're done with it. And unfortunately, some people who encounter Buddhist teachings will have a simplistic idea of desire. And in the extreme simplistic kind of misunderstanding is the idea that desire is wrong, that somehow desire is bad. Occasionally in English literature, the Buddhist teachings on the Four Noble Truths, people explain it that desire is the cause of suffering. And so you should come to the end of desire, not have desire. And now that's certainly not accurate, and certainly not helpful to have such a narrow understanding of desire. But rather, it functions so many different ways in our lives. And having said that, there seems to be a principle in the teachings of the Buddha that guides us in our studies and our evaluation of how we live our lives, and certainly how desires function. And that's a relatively simple principle. And saying it in the most general way would be, is how we're living, our choices we make, is the ways in which we pursue things or our desires, is it beneficial or is it not? Is it harmful or is it not? Does it bring well-being or does it bring, I guess we don't say ill-being so much in English, but the opposite of well-being. And so it's kind of like there's a fork in the road. And in this way, the Buddha's teachings are a little bit simple, a simple principle that you always find yourself at a fork. And which fork do you take? Do you go in the direction of greater well-being, or do you go in directions that are more harmful for yourself and for other people? And so in this regard, I think it's helpful to consider two different forms of desire, one which leads in one direction in the fork, and the other which has more to do with the other direction. And the kind of desire that leads to harm, both to ourselves and to others sometimes, one way or the other, would be called craving. And craving apparently comes from a Greek or Latin root that means to claw. So maybe some of you have been the recipients of someone's craving. And, you know, it's like, you know, I've been around little kids who have had cravings, and I think it's looked like clawing. And so it can happen that way. And then the other direction that desire can take, I like to represent by the term aspiration. And I like this word a lot because of it's one of these words from Latin roots that comes from the word spirare, which means to breathe. So even the word spirit or spiritual has this relationship with Latin to breathing. And breathing is like one of the best things. And in these 42 years I've been studying, desire, I've been studying breathing also. And just as much as I've been a student of desire, I've been a student of breathing. And so how does breathing function? Is breathing relaxed? Is it open? Is it settled? Is it contracted? Is it tight? Is it speeded up? What goes on in the breathing? What muscles in the chest, in the belly, and diaphragm are engaged as we breathe? Is there a feeling of being held or contracted as I breathe? Or is the breathing field expansive and open and fluid? How is the breathing? And as we study breathing and how breathing happens, we can feel the difference between an easy breath, breath which is at ease, and one that is not. And so some forms of desire have an effect on breathing. Some can have caused the breathing to tighten up. So I think strong craving, I think, has a deleterious effect on breathing. Aspiration, with this coming from, with breathing, coming together with the word breath, that is the desire that arises out of a relaxed breath, the fluid breath, the kind of breath that breathing, or kind of inner life or inner spirit that is settled, relaxed, that maybe is not driven by craving, not driven by kind of being disconnected from ourselves, but one that's connected or arises out of being deeply connected. I think of craving as being, it certainly is inherent in human beings to be able to crave, to have that kind of strong clawing desire for something. But I think that it's alienating. It has a way of kind of focusing so much on the object, what we want. It's kind of like a grasping from the surface of our being at something. It can be frustrating, it can be exhausting. It kind of creates a fog, certain kinds of strong desire where we see through that fog, or we, through rose-colored glasses, or through just, fogged-over glasses. We don't really see very clearly. And so it kind of, I think of it as more of a surface activity of the human being. Aspiration, I think of something coming from the depths of who we are. And part of the function of meditation is to help us get down into the depths, find out in the depths what's going on in there, and what are the motivations, what arises out of that depth. And rather than thinking it has to be something complicated, some, complicated idea of, what arises, my aspiration is galactic peace, and I'm going to, fight the cause or something. There's a kind of reference point that being settled and being kind of connected to the depth of who we are, the fullness of who we are, which is very much connected to this simple thing about, does it bring welfare or does it bring happiness? Does it bring happiness or does it bring suffering? Does it bring welfare or does it bring harm to us? And that is, you can feel viscerally, you can feel physically, you can feel kind of the inside when something feels off and when something feels more of a rightness to it. And the Buddha referred to this by the Pali word kusala, which has different ways of being translated into English, but my favorite these days is wholesome and unwholesome. There are certain things which feel in and of themselves to be wholesome, to be nourishing, to feed the goodness in us, to feed what's really right in us, to move us towards beneficial states. And there are those things which are akusala, which are unwholesome, which feel off in and of themselves. There's a tightness, contraction, irritation. It hurts to have these things. And they move us to greater states of unwholesomeness. So something like greed, craving, lust are all forms of desire. But if you feel what it's like to have them in us, to feel from a settled, deep place, if you're really deeply settled, relaxed, and at home in yourself, at peace here, and a good old-fashioned kind of craving or lust arises that's really strong, you can feel that we lose something in that process. Even though the craving, the promise of the craving might be very great pleasure, something wonderful, and the imagination can feel the pleasantness of imagining that possibility, it is a kind of leaving the depths of who we are. It's leaving the fullness of who we are. And there's a contraction, a narrowing, sometimes a narrowing into this imaginary pleasure and what that is like. And there's a loss of something. And you can feel that. And if it's very strong craving, strong desire, not only is it a loss of something here, but it tends to be onward leading to more unwholesomeness, to more unhealthiness, to more things which to create that kind of contraction for us. That which comes from aspiration, that which is wholesome, the desires that are for our betterment, and they come from that deep, subtle place, they feel good. They feel like they have integrity, or they feel like they have a wholesomeness or a nourishing quality. They feel satisfying. There's a kind of pleasure in them that feels deep, feels a rightness. And as we act on them, they tend to bring further benefit, more wholesome states. So one aspiration is compassion, to want to help other people in their suffering. And if that's a clean kind of compassion, that's a wholesome state. It actually can feel healthy and actually nourishing in ourselves to feel pure compassion operating. And then to act on that aspiration of compassion, if we do it in a wise way, tends to cultivate or strengthen further compassion, or strengthen this orientation towards a healthy quality of inner life. So in Buddhism, we are the custodians of the quality of our inner life. No one else can be the custodian. Other people can do all kinds of things around us, behave in all kinds of unfortunate and fortunate ways, but they are not the custodian of your inner life. Only you can do that. And so how do you care for that? How do you take responsibility for it? How do you monitor that? And so there's this kind of simple dichotomy or fork in the road that the Buddha points to. Can you see whether it moves in directions of harm or unwholesomeness, or can you feel or know how it moves in directions of wholesomeness? So craving moves in one direction, and aspiration is the categories of desire that move in the other direction. And in fact, the Buddha encouraged desire, certain kinds of desire. He encouraged the desire for what is wholesome, desire for cultivating the qualities that lead to greater freedom and greater peace, greater well-being in ourselves. And then in a way that we have to kind of be careful how we take it in and not hear it as the only thing he taught. He said we should, I'm paraphrasing him, but we want to use desire, healthy desire, in such a way to bring about the end of desire. Isn't that nice? Or is that frightening? But not once and for all. You can't just, I don't think a human being can live without any desire. Most people have no desires or depressed. So, it's not really a goal to end up with no desire. But to have a different relationship desire, to come to new forms of desire and a different way of being with desire, yes. And one of the ways the Buddha talked about this, coming to that new relationship, is to come to the end of desire, at least temporarily. And that's, one of the purposes of Buddhist practice is to have a desire to follow a path, to cultivate wholesomeness, to cultivate these good qualities, to develop mindfulness, develop concentration, develop compassion and kindness, to develop strength, equanimity, so that the mind begins to have a feeling or sense of not being caught up in desire, not being driven by desire. And one of the things that I discovered in my study of desire in my mind was I had a wonderful capacity to have uninterrupted desires. You know, here I was trying to get concentrated, you know, on my breathing, you know. I had this idea, I can't concentrate, you know. I have to, you know, keep getting lost. I can't concentrate. But in fact, I was very well concentrated. I was concentrated on having desires. And so I had to learn how to shift, you know, and not be so focused or committed or interested or fascinated or fear-driven around desire. I had to kind of soften that and let go. So that wasn't the main object of concentration. And I suspect that some of you are the same way, that if it occurs to you, boy, I don't have much ability to concentrate. Well, maybe you don't because, you know, have much ability to concentrate on something that you choose to concentrate on, but your mind has probably just, you know, all the capacity for concentration it needs. It has its own mind. It's, you know, it's concentrated on something else. Some people are concentrated on fear and anxiety. Some people specialize on that. They have, like, you know, you know, real one-pointed concentration, absorption and anxiety. Some people have it on desire. Some people on hate. Some people on just being confused. And, you know, and the mind just goes there. And I say that because I know some people for whom the issue of confusion is a really huge, you know, life issue for them. And they really struggle with it. And the way they struggle with it, they're really caught in its grip. And they have such a strong need to find some stability or security. But the confusion thing is frightening. And so there's a kind of concentration there. I say all these things with respect for how it is for people in their minds. But we are trying to study all this and see how it works so that we can begin having healthy desires, and we can have a desire to get settled and peaceful and concentrated, and that can be a good desire, and then be able to follow through with it in a way that's useful. So one of the parts of this study, the study of desire, is how we desire. So you can certainly study what you desire, and there's many, many things to desire. And when you do that, the Buddha suggests, evaluate it, that whatever you desire, evaluate from the point of view, is it helpful for this quality of my inner life or not? But then it's also how we desire. And there can be completely appropriate desires, what looks like a healthy desire, but how we approach the desire is not healthy. How we approach the desire doesn't support this good inner quality of being. So, you know, maybe you're hungry and wanting to eat is a nice desire, is appropriate desire. But, you know, if you then become so driven to find food desperately that you're driving over people on the way to the supermarket, that's not you're not holding that desire in a healthy way. If we have a desire for world peace or to do good in the world, but the desire is driven by wanting to have status or wanting to be approved, get approval from people, you know, that how we are, what we're adding to the desire is not very healthy. Doesn't help this inner quality of being. If we have desire, but we expect to succeed, and we measure or we bring along with desire all kinds of unfortunate ideas of success, of expectation, of needing to succeed, then that's a kind of recipe, can be a recipe for suffering, for getting more contracted and actually causing further the harm in this inner quality we have. Or can we have desire, strong desire, desire that we maybe put a lot of strong effort into, but there's no expectation of succeeding, or we're not depending on succeeding, or we're not tying it to our self-image. We're not looking for approval from other people. We put a lot of effort into it, but there's no contraction in the effort. We don't get tight. We can stay kind of relaxed and engaged and just, you know, fully, wholeheartedly involved. in what we're doing. And this was part of my early years of monastic training. One of the parts of that training was how to do things wholeheartedly, where we put our our whole being into what we were doing, but to do it in a relaxed way. And I had no idea that there was such a possibility. I thought that you either had to, if you're going to really do something, you had to get, I don't know what, but you had to kind of tighten up and bear down and strain. But how to be wholehearted and not strain. It was fascinating in the monastery to learn to do things quickly. Originally I thought Buddhists do things slow and mindful. But sometimes in the monastery we didn't have time for that. We had to do things quickly. And how do you do things quickly without straining? Just be there in a full way. So how we have desires and how we act on desires is something, it's different than what the desire is. And sometimes people get fooled by the authority of what we want, by how important it is or how right it is, that they don't never step back and look at how we're acting on the desire, how we relate to the desire. And the image I like to do for this is for almost anything, any kind of holding to anything, is the difference between holding something like I'm holding the striker and holding it really tight, or versus holding it loose. And I have my hand now palm open and the striker just rests in the middle of it. When I was taught how to ring the bells in the monastery, we were taught to hold the bell really lightly between two fingers, kind of like so almost the striker would almost fall out of our hands, but not quite, just very, very lightly, loosely. And then when we went to strike the bell, we would kind of just almost like you almost like let go of your grip, your hold of it, and then you would just kind of let it drop. And as it struck the bell, you'd pick it up, and you kind of did this. I'll show you how we do it. So, in the monastery, so you make kind of an arc. So you hold it loosely like this. And then you come from below, and you drop the striker against the corner here, and then as it glances off the corner of the top, you keep lifting it up beyond the arc like this. See that? So. Now, if I think it's really important to ring this bell, and the desire for ringing it is like the most important thing, and I have to really, really kind of hold that tight and make sure that I really manage to... there's other ways of doing it, right? Sometimes holding a desire lightly is the most effective way of accomplishing what we want. Sometimes holding the desire tightly and kind of being anxious about it is actually how to make it not work. Sometimes having a desire and knowing when to drop it and not have it is important in succeeding in the desire. So, for example, you all came to IMC today, and so I imagine, unless you were forced here, I imagine that you had the desire to come. And I would say that I hope that was a healthy desire for you. It could have been unhealthy. You just got a new set of clothes and you want to show off to the Buddhists. that's certainly interesting. And I don't know if this is the right audience for that. But I imagine, you had a desire to come here. And and so that's good. Once you got here, drop the desire. Don't continue having the desire to come here once you're here. That doesn't serve you. That doesn't gets in the way. Or you get here and you start meditating, say, this meditation is good. And then you start planning all the other times you're going to come. I'll come next, I'll come tomorrow and the next day. And by the time they ring the bell at the end of the sitting, you've spent the whole, session of meditation, desiring further times to come because it's so good to come. And you weren't really here for this time. You missed this time, right? So it's good to have the desire, and then it's good to know how to stop it, to drop it. Once you're here. Or if you want to get concentrated when you're here, that's a good desire to have. And there's an art there too of knowing how to kind of set the momentum going, but then drop the desire. So it's not kind of, you're not caught up in it all the time, and it's measuring yourself, and you know. And then some desires are fine to have, but they're actually, the whole thing works better if you don't act on it. And I like, the example I like is that of the two things that I, in recent life, my recent life where I've seen it operate clearly is cats and little kids. That sometimes if you go directly up to a cat who doesn't know you, or a little kid who doesn't know you, the kid runs away, the cat runs away, it's too much. But if you ignore them when you come into their house, if you just ignore them, don't act on the desire, and you sit there and look the other way, talk to the parent, or you know, just do something. And then after a while, these two living beings will sometimes then, you know, decide, oh, you're safe, and get curious, and will come up, and you know, and you're not threatening them. So the desire to spend time with these, you know, the cat or the kid is a fine desire, but we have to know how to drop the desire. So this whole world of desire, how do we hold it? Can we relate to it in a wise way? Now, to help with this study and help with having a wise relationship desire, one of the things about meditation, something like meditation, it's a place, it's like going to the gym, where you get to work out in a certain way. And the way you work out is you try to let go of any desires which are unnecessary for the purpose of meditating. And so you're sitting there and you start thinking about, yes, you know, I'd like to have a nice lunch, and what should I order, what should I make for lunch when I get home from IMC? That's a desire. It might be appropriate desire once you get home or some point. But, you know, to do it during your meditation, this is a time when we exercise our capacity to let go. You don't have to think about your lunch when you're sitting to meditate. There's all kinds, a whole series of desires, you know, infinite number of desires that I could probably list for you, which aren't necessary when you're meditating. They might be necessary at other times, they might be important desires and issues in your life, but they're not really necessary now. So you sit here and you think, well, I really want to check my email. Is it necessary? How many times in your daily life do you check email, not out of some healthy desire, it's appropriate and seems, you know, wonderful and aspiration to check email, and how often is it kind of a compulsion? You know, like, oh, you know, I have some free moments here, I better check. You know, why should I stand here and do nothing? Well, when I can check my phone. And, you know, this compulsion to check. So we're training ourselves in meditation over and over and over again to let go of desire, to let go of desires. There might be some desires are useful while we meditate, so we hold those wisely, but to let go, let go, let go. And it's kind of like the gym. It's kind of like you're working out, learning a capacity. As you learn this capacity and know how to do that, then as you go about your life beyond here, then that becomes an ability you have, that becomes a reference point you have, and maybe you've had an experience of yourself of what it's really like to breathe, to be present, to be at ease, to be at peace in your mind, where you're not caught up in desire. And that reference point can show us much more clearly when we're caught in the grip of desire. Many people don't even know they're caught in desire because it's kind of like, you know, it's kind of like the fish supposedly doesn't see the water it swims in. It's just like so common. It's just like this is, you know, it's if you ask people, are you having a desire? No, I haven't had a desire for a long time. You ask a meditator who's been meditating for some time and has watched their mind for some time, you know, have you been desiring? Oh, yeah. Yep. I sure have, and I wish I wasn't so much, because I know an alternative. So becoming a student of desire, being able to see clearly what happens in a desire, how they operate, how they work, what the consequences are from having desires. Are we better off because of the desire, because of acting on the desire? Is the quality of our deep inner life better off from how we acted or not? How many times do we act on desire, and if we really stopped and paid attention, we'd realize actually we're actually worse off on the inside. Even though the desire brought some pleasure and happiness, it really wasn't that deep. How do we become the custodian of our own lives, of our inner lives? And I propose that one way to become a custodian is to become a student of your desires. And when there's one teaching of the Buddha where he talks about this kind of idea of being a student of desire. He said that, to paraphrase him a little bit, you're a student when you're studying desire. You're a student when you're studying desire. You have a teacher when your desires are compulsive. Isn't that an interesting idea? If you want a teacher, just wait for compulsive desires. How I take this little teaching of the Buddha is when there's compulsive desires or craving desires, when you have a teacher in India, you listen, you stop and pay attention. You really want to take the lessons in from your teacher, your guru. So your craving desires are your guru. Not to believe it, not to act on it, but to really take in the lesson so you can really discover what's really going on in a deeper way. Does that make some sense? So we have some time, and if any of you desire to ask a question... yes, that was fast.
So first off, thanks for the talk. Uh-huh. I think that really resonated with me. I've noticed in life...
Is it green light?
Green light's on. Hello. Hello.
There.
Can you hear me? I was just going to ask, I think I've observed the same sort of phenomena of how desire has like a tense or craving quality, even for things that are good, you know, that you want that are good for you, like I want to meditate more, or I want to exercise, or I want to do well at work. And I've noticed that that's not... It can be unhealthy because you can even put judgment and fear on how well you're doing at those things. And so for me, I when I was observing it, I noticed that maybe some of those things are driven more by fear than by love. And so I've been trying to say, okay, well, maybe I should try to do well at things out of a place of love rather than fear. And so I was wondering if you could speak more on that quality you said of wholehearted but committed motivation to achieving something, which you said you experienced at the monastery where, it was a different type of aspirational uh-huh. desire.
Great.
And how we can cultivate that.
Great. Could you hear everyone? Could hear? I'm not there. So the question is, there might be a wholesome desire, but an unwholesome way of holding it and might be driven by fear, for example. And maybe there's wholesome ways of acting on that desire, maybe out of love. And could I talk a little bit about this topic? So, I have the impression that it might be generally more useful to study the fear than try to pull up the love. Because if you go too quickly to love or trying to do it wholeheartedly or something, and you're covering over the fear, it might be kind of awkward in there. It might actually be unhealthy because the fear might still be there, but in the background. If you have some, like for example, if you have some idea that, well, love is the opposite of fear, so I should work out of love, and I got to get this love going. That's nice, but maybe that's not really the appropriate wholesome motivation, a wholesome quality. Then it seemed like it's good, but maybe there's something else. But rather turn towards the fear, study the fear, and see if you can settle the fear. or work through the fear, understand the fear deeply. So the fear is not interfering. And then there's space for some other motivation to come. And it might be that it's not love that is the primary motivating factor for work, but maybe what really speaks to you and what really does something nice is generosity. And that feels more, has more integrity to you than the idea of doing what you do out of love. And does that make sense? So I'd encourage you to become friends with your fear. Take time with it and get to know it. Yes? What's with Mike? Yeah, please.
And going forward from that, even if we hold a desire in a wholesome manner, but then it doesn't really come to fruition and we feel disappointed, what would the Buddha say to do then?
So if we have a wholesome desire and we engaged in it, but it doesn't come to fruition and we're disappointed, what would the Buddha say then? I don't know if that particular question is ever addressed in the surviving literature. I'm not sure what the Buddha would say, that I'm reluctant to put words in his mouth. But I think that I think with all these things, we have to be careful with our English word, the words we use, the concepts we use. So the operating word, I think, is disappointment. And so then we become a student of disappointment. What's the nature of disappointment? And is there any attachment in disappointment? Is there any judgments? Are there any values that go into the beliefs that go into the disappointment that are unnecessary, that are, you know, coming from something unwholesome? Or is it pretty clean to be disappointed? You know, that idea, this was important to do, I was wholesome to do, I did it, and it didn't work out. And yeah, so, well, that was disappointing. But the disappointment doesn't linger. You're not stuck in it. It doesn't, you know, you don't lose sleep over it. So, okay, I'll try better next time. So to look at the nature of the disappointment and what you believe. There are some people who, like myself, I think, maybe it's just a personality thing, or I don't know if it's come from my practice, where I enjoy doing things more than succeeding. So, you know, it's nice to succeed, but, you know, that's not that important. I try to do things which are good, and it would be good if they succeed, but I enjoy the activity of them more than... And once I succeed, well, then let's go on to the next thing. So did this some way address your question, or you want to ask again, or more specifically, or is it good enough?
So the Buddha offers different ways to let go of craving. One is meditative joy, the jhanas, which is more wholesome. So he offers it as an alternative because it's very difficult for people to let go of craving. It's not that easy. But in psychology, there is another way to let go of craving. This is commonly talked about. If you hold a striker very tight and you just look at it, after a while it loses the grip. Sometimes it's very difficult in complex problems. So the way they recommend is break it down into simpler parts. For example, if you crave a three-course meal, then break it down into its components, the dessert. Okay, then you look at the dessert. Yeah, it gives me a small satisfaction, but it's impermanent. It goes away. So that way, apparently, is very effective. And I've tried it out. It seems to work. Does the Buddha talk about this?
I guess I'd like to... I thought you said three things which were nice. Let's see if I can get to your question. So the first thing you said was that... the Buddha does talk about sometimes about certain of the strong desires people have, especially a sensual desire, desire for sensuality and sexuality, which is such a strong biological thing. It's very hard to kind of, you know, these things are strongly driven by our biology, come with a certain authority which is deeper than what we think, and it just seems like it has to be or something. It's very hard to kind of find our way with it. And one of the things he offered for that was deep meditative joy. that there is healthy kinds of joy and rapture and ecstasy that can arise, sense of well-being from meditation, that that people who experience it in a really full, complete way say it's actually much better than most or all sensual things, even sexual pleasure. And so when you know something is better, and it has a simplicity to it and a healthiness to it, and it can last longer, some people, that begins to relax the grip of some of these sensual desires. And then the idea of looking at the tightly held clinging is one of the principles of mindfulness. Sometimes it's actually wiser not to be the one who lets go, but to just spend a lot of time looking carefully at it. Because I talked earlier about, you know, practicing letting go, but at some point you want to stop letting go in favor of just looking. Because when you're the agent who's letting go, it can reinforce a subtle desires of various kinds of being, I'm in charge, I get to accomplish what I want, all kinds of little extra things that go on. But it's very powerful just to kind of hold in the gaze of our attention, the whole, you know, whatever way we're caught or holding on tight, and just look at it peacefully, calmly, and don't try to get rid of it, but really kind of hold your gaze on the desires you have and see what happens. Generally, it begins to relax. And then you said that this idea of breaking up the desire, so you have a desire for a three-course meal, but if you look at the particular details of it, then it's not so compelling. I think what you're describing here is the idea that the idea of the whole three-course meal is a fantasy, is a kind of a abstraction. It's kind of an idea. And so sometimes we're living in the world, the virtual world of ideas, and we're pursuing desires which are, to a certain kind of way, imaginary. I mean, if you have the three-course meal, it's not really imaginary, but the way the desire is relating to the whole show is a kind of construct of abstraction. And if you stop abstracting, stop looking at the imaginary abstraction of what we're doing, and start looking at the particular details, what's actually real and particular and in the moment experience we're having, we find out that, you know, it's not that attractive and interesting, or it's easier to be free of it than if it's a big, big abstraction. So this idea of no longer settling the mind, relaxing the mind, so it's not caught up in thoughts, is very helpful because it breaks the allure, the seduction of these big abstract ideas about what this will do for me in my life. Is that close enough?
Yep.
Okay, so one more. And
thank you for your talk and for these excellent answers to your questions. This gentleman mentioned fear, and you talked about studying fear. Can you give some suggestions about how to do that? What you would...
How to...
Step by step of how you would study fear. When you said study the fear, rather than move on to the love, study the fear.
This is a great question. I appreciate it a lot. And I'm sure a lot of people want to know the answer for that. But sometimes it's the wisest... maybe wisest for me to turn the question around to the person who asked the question. You just finished a week-long retreat yesterday. Week-long mindfulness retreat. What did you learn during that retreat about how to be with fear? Anything about that retreat that is relevant in this question?
There's a lot that was relevant. It's a very challenging question, actually. I think one thing is to try to feel the physical sensations of it, but sometimes the minute you do that, it's hard to find them. They're there. They were there in the instant of feeling the fear, even though we may not have been consciously aware of it. But the minute you I try to say, well, what is being held in my stomach or in my head, or you know, suddenly they kind of evaporate.
Mm.
So it's challenging to kind of figure that out.
Oh.
So
and when these physical symptoms of fear evaporate, what happens to the fear?
Not sure. I think it's different at different times, probably.
Yeah.
It's probably still there in some way.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes you've talked about the mental, you know, relaxing the muscle. And I think there's some of that. It can be there also.
Uh-huh.
Those are my thoughts.
Great. So I think what you said there is one of the primary ways that and mindfulness works well with fear, is to really feel it physically. And because the physical sensations are not what we're afraid of usually. And so it's an easier way to connect to the fear and see what goes on. And if the physical sensations begin to shift and change, it also means that probably the nature of the fear is shifting and changing. And one of the things that can happen is that some of the physical sensations of fear, if they lessen, the fear lessens. Or the fear begins to morph and change and show different aspects of itself. Maybe the underlying belief or the underlying desires that are behind the fear itself. Thank you. So we should stop. And we have, otherwise we are a captive audience. So thank you. And I hope that you can be, it's useful for you to be students of your desire. Thank you.